You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, January 11th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Dave Weigel wrapping the not terribly dramatic New Hampshire primary. But I've still got a couple of questions, particularly about how those Republicans fared who attacked Mitt Romney for his work at Bain Capital, and to look forward so that we don't have to deal with this primary stuff for another 2 weeks. Also, later in the program, Occupy New Hampshire, a wrap on their activities during that primary. And folks, the week coming up, I think, is going to be one of the most active for Occupy in probably the past month. A lot of different activities happening across the country, particularly in D.C. and in New York. All that and more. Interesting story on, interesting follow-up on a bank story that we had talked about. Seems like a couple of months ago now. This story from Reuters today. The New York State's financial regulator is probing several large banks, including Bank of America Corp and Citigroup, on whether they overcharged customers on force place insurance. This is an interesting story for what is not in here. And I just assume that whoever the reporter was just is not aware of the previous story on force place insurance. The probe centers on so-called force place insurance, where the loan servicer steps in and buys an insurance policy in the event a homeowner fails to keep up the insurance premiums. In other words, it's mortgage insurance. J.P. Morgan and Chase and Company, Wells Fargo Company, are among the major banks. By the inquiry of the office of Benjamin Losky, a superintendent of New York State's Department of Financial Services, the present probe would look into whether policies being taken up by the investigative banks were issued by their own affiliates. Kickbacks between unrelated companies would also face scrutiny, according to the source. An important focus for the probe will be the potential conflict at Bank of America involving a unit called Balboa Insurance that it owned until last year. The investigation will also probe J.P. Morgan, because in recent years, the bank held a small financial stake in an insurance company called Assurant on behalf of its clients. Now, as soon as I read this, I remembered that story that I don't know if it came out 3-4 months ago. I'm much better remembering stories than I am time, apparently. But if you recall, there was a story that an office of HUD, I believe it was in St. Louis, stumbled upon this practice by banks about 3 to 4 years ago. I think closer to 3 years ago now. They delivered a massive dossier to the Department of Justice recounting how they found that several large banks were involved in the following scam. And it's a scam because it's completely illegal. when you take out a mortgage, if your financials are not in great shape, the bank will force you to buy mortgage insurance to qualify for that mortgage. And invariably what happens is a third party comes in and sells you that mortgage. But what the banks were doing at this point were setting up subsidiaries. And when they sent essentially the borrower to this third party, let's call them Matt's Mortgage Insurance Company, they would tell the mortgage insurance company, so basically I'm the bank, Matt's the mortgage insurance company, Matt, we're going to send the business to you, but guess what you're going to do? You are going to reinsure that policy that you just sold to our borrower with our subsidiary. However, we're going to take half the premiums, but we're not going to take half the risk. You're going to give us half the amount of money that you get for that insurance, and we're just going to cover one third of the risk that you're involved in. That's patently illegal, both in the sense that it's a kickback, and it's specifically a kickback because I'm not assuming the legitimate risk involved in that insurance. Now, this dossier was delivered to the Department of Justice 2 years ago, and they did nothing with it. Nothing. And this is according to HUD officials who spoke on and off the record in this story. And so it's very interesting that we're now seeing the New York State regulators pick up on this. And it's also interesting that during that time, Bank of America and I guess it was J.P. Morgan shed the subsidiaries that were engaged in these kickbacks. It's fascinating. This is not over in terms of this massive amount of fraud that was involved in these mortgages. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dave Weigel on just what took place in New Hampshire and what he expects will take place in the future. Is it over? Is it Romney's now? Do we not have to pay attention again to this until the spring when things start heating up with Occupy? I hope so. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. I assume he, I don't know if he's still up there. He's left New Hampshire. But Dave Weigel from Slate.com, who has been following this Republican primary. I mean, not just, I mean, literally following it. Welcome to the program, David.
Good to be back. And I'm in Boston. I'm making a very, very slow way out of New Hampshire because I hate to leave it so much.
No, I can imagine. It's wonderful this time of year. All the leaves are gone and it's cold and there's some salt and dirt on the ground from when they've had to sand the roads for snow.
That's right. I mean, it used to be people cuddling up against each other for warmth, dreaming of Florida. You see Midnight Cowboy. You know how it works.
Oh yeah, no, I definitely have. In fact, I've done that Boston to Florida route by car multiple times back in the day. You know, bringing cars down to Snowbirds down to West Palm Beach.
Oh great! I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to talk to you instead.
If you're interested in earning $250, I know exactly. All right, so let's first start with, obviously, Mitt Romney won, not terribly unexpected. Was his margin something that came within expectations?
Yeah, I'm noticing some columns and pieces today along the lines of why did we cover this? This is so predictable. The you know, this is a waste of time. And I would give you, I would put points up for anyone who says that, because even this result was exactly the most boring result you could have. He didn't blow past like 40 or 45%, which would have meant that he had true momentum. He didn't fall below 30, which was not something we were dreaming about. I didn't think it was possible. I mean, by he, I mean Romney now.
Right.
And, you know, Paul got the 2% that it felt like the media was collectively wishing he wouldn't get. The last 24 hours, I spent some time with Paul, and he had, you know, I guess a 6-to-1 ratio of people to media, and Huntsman had about a 3-to-1 media to person ratio. Just You could tell the press really, really wanted, and not for any malicious reason. It was like, it was a good story, and then anyway, the guy was picking up steam. The press wanted to see Huntsman come in second.
I think the most interesting, I mean, to the extent that there's anything that's interesting that comes out, that came out of New Hampshire, I think it had to do more with who voted for Romney and why, and,
right.
And what happens next. I mean, he did better, amongst, rich people. He did better, with moderates.
Although they might've had their butlers vote for them. I didn't check. There is no voter ID here. So we might've.
Right, of course. No, it's a huge scam. The rich people, that's why there's such outcry against the voter ID laws, is because the rich people want to send their butlers down there so they don't have to do it. I guess the big story is that a lot of people voted for him because they think he can beat Obama. And then the question becomes, does what happened in New Hampshire give us any further clues to just how oriented Republicans are, how excited they are to defeat Obama? The numbers turnout was a little bit lower this year, wasn't it, than last 2008?
Well, you know, the turnout was actually higher, but not among Republicans. I mean, I saw the Republican National Committee trying to spin this and making fun of how not many people turned out for the Democratic primary where everyone voted for Obama. There were so many independents showing up for Ron Paul that it was actually, you know, the pure Republican turnout for this was like 140,000 in 2008 and about 125,000 this time, estimating from what people told the pollsters. A lot of independents turned out for Paul, and their motivation is different than the motivation of the Republican who just wants to beat Obama. So just like in Iowa, I mean, that you've got people who vote for Romney because they think he can win. And you do meet, especially in New Hampshire, in Massachusetts, you meet people who really, really like Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually vanishingly rare outside of, you know, even Hillsborough County, New Hampshire. It's vanishingly rare in the rest of the country. They have been told that he can win. Polls say that he can win. Certainly, logic dictates, if you could look at him and then look at Newt Gingrich, that he can win more easily than Gingrich can. And so, yeah, it's a bit. It feels the comparison du jour is really to John Kerry in 2004, where people thought he offered something that would beat George Bush, and they went for him even though they didn't love him.
Right. And the other thing that I found interesting was the attacks by the Republicans on Romney from the perspective of his work with Bain Capital. We saw Gingrich come out. Now, Gingrich seems to really have a deep, visceral hatred of Romney, which apparently is not that rare. You know, Gingrich is well known to be a petty guy. Rick Perry also went after Romney in this fashion. In fact, I think the only person who defended his record at Bain was Ron Paul, which I want to get to next. But there seemed to be a massive sort of pushback by the Republican establishment for that line of attacks. Those attacks resonate? Is there anything that came out of those attacks other than perhaps writing the script for the Democrats over the summer?
Well, the Democrats are already trying to write that script, but they weren't getting taken that seriously. I mean, they would put out press releases about Romney and Gordon Gekko and statements about Bain, but no one paid attention until Newt Gingrich's super PAC bought a 27-minute movie, which I've watched, called When Mitt Romney Came to Town. And they cast him as just a rapacious, evil evil capitalist who basically strip-mined. He's kind of like the villain in The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, just like taking away precious resources and bodily fluids from everything he touches. And I didn't meet voters. I mean, I drove to four towns yesterday and talked to voters. I didn't really meet any who factored that attack in. So this was kind of a demo. This was something that Gingrich is going to try more with kind of lower class, not, you know what I mean, people who have less money, fewer butlers in South Carolina, and see if it works. And Democrats are happy. I mean, there's this conventional wisdom in politics. Sorry, there's a truck back behind me. There's a conventional wisdom in politics that...
Hold on, let me give you this.
If an attack is used once, then it loses all of its steam the next time. But this is such a fundamental attack about Mitt Romney's character. And the thing I always come back to is the Swift Boat of Veterans actually came out in April 2004, and no one paid attention, but they came back around with more money later in the year.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is something that the media has... Boston media's done a good job, especially, of investigating Bain. Not that they did anything wrong, just like what kind of company they were. So it is probably in the long run bad for Romney for him to be exposed as not a great creator of wealth, but a venture capitalist. I mean, Gingrich was doing talk radio rounds yesterday and trying to explain this and saying, look, you know, there's a difference between Sam Walton or Steve Jobs and some guy who sees a struggling company, fires everybody and over leverages them to make money off it.
Right. I mean, at the end of the day, the argument is more about the social utility of people like of outfits that are similar to Bain in terms of them going in and extracting money from these companies rather than really looking to develop them as functioning entities going forward. All right, be that as it may, I mean, I'm just curious. So is he going to run that 27-minute movie in South Carolina, like on TV, or is that just something that, you know, we can see on Netflix or I can rent on demand? And is it
the
funny?
The Super PAC's been leaking it selectively to people. I kind of lucked out and saw a copy 2 days ago, and I think Bloomberg got a copy yesterday. It's just the right length for if you wanted to throw it on TV, like that old, you remember 2004, you remember that Stolen Honor documentary that Sirius wanted to run? You could. But unfortunately for Gingrich, Sheldon Adelson, who's funding that pack, doesn't have a bunch of TV stations to run it on. I think what they're going to do instead is cut it into 60-second TV ads, which show people who lost their jobs at a washing machine company, KB Toys, all these places, explaining that Mitt Romney I'm using a cliche from one of these workers. He pulled the rug out from under our factory. It's kind of a nice mixed metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Most factories have concrete floors, but I think that's you're going to see it cut up like that. I should say though, in the exit polls, most they ask when you decided in the last 3 days, the last day. Mitt Romney actually did very well with people who decided in this primary in the last day. He won those people, and the wisdom among the press corps was that this story and him kind of joke saying he liked to be able to fire people if they were providing a bad service to him. That didn't hit him at all in the Republican primary, which either means that Republicans will never give in for this and care about this, or that they just haven't absorbed it yet.
Or it could also be, you know, sort of the history of New Hampshire, which is not, was never a big manufacturing state necessarily. And down in South Carolina, it's going to be interesting to see if that has more impact. The other thing that I found interesting was which I didn't know until yesterday, people started putting this out there, that John Huntsman's essentially waiting to see if his dad will allow him to continue this campaign.
Yeah, and Huntsman's done something that I think every candidate now is doing this, but it's still a little bit weird and untoward. And his super PAC changed its filing status so that it doesn't have to announce until after Florida who's funding it. So the thinking is, his father, who's, you know, billionaire, has created a lot of things, can just throw $50 million into a Florida campaign. I have no telepathic link to the Huntsmans. I don't know why they wouldn't have done this before New Hampshire. The way things shook out, Ron Paul was so strong that maybe Huntsman couldn't have passed him anyway. But it seems weird if you're making your stand in New Hampshire. It would have been a great headline if the guy came close to Romney. Why wait until Florida when it costs much, much, much more money to do something like that?
I just cannot imagine the hell it must be for a guy like Huntsman to have to wait on your dad to see if you can. I mean, that must just suck. I got to see if I'm going to get more money for my campaign if dad wasn't such a – just please – you know, my father actually prevented me from getting my driver's license for like an extra 3 months because I was grounded or something. So I know exactly how that feels. So my sympathies go to Huntsman. So what's going to happen in South Carolina? Romney's up in the polls. Is this thing more or less over, or what could surprise people? And I guess before we even get to that, let me ask you one more question about New Hampshire. Ron Paul seemed to me in his acceptance speech last night, acceptance of second place, I guess, or his victory speech or whatever you want to call it. There was two things that stood out to me. One was he seemed to be specifically friendly to Romney, and also seemed to be sort of like dialing back, at least relative to the debates, some of his we want to get rid of our empire language. There was more talk of like an orderly leaving of Afghanistan. He kept saying orderly, it seemed to me. Tell me your sense of that.
Well, he's really quite a good politician, despite all appearances. I noticed I spent a little bit of time at his campaign office with his volunteers, and the guys who put in the real sweat equity for him are really radical. I mean, they really want the empire, I'll just keep using that phrasing, to be taken apart, America to, you know, they're basically pure America First libertarians, and so is he. But they're willing to work for him, even though he will come from the base. But his campaign literature barely mentions foreign policy. He had, I think, 14 little flyers that they would hand out, none of which were specifically about foreign policy. And he had a doorknob thing where you go and try to talk to a voter, and he's not there, you hang an ad on the door. It only kind of mentioned defense cuts, didn't mention foreign policy, and so. He's willing to settle that if he thinks it'll get him votes.
He specifically said last night, he said something weird that I didn't understand. I mean, there was a lot of things, actually, that he said that I didn't understand. But he said, I'm not going to cut U.S. defense. I'm just going to cut parts of the military budget. What does that mean?
Good question. I'm trying to think here. He means that he will basically pull us out of bases around the world, and he will never involve us in a foreign war of choice, basically get us I think also implicit in that are the kind of things Rand Paul talks more about, which are cuts to big expensive new military technology investments like that, but he will fully fund veterans care and, you know, the land military that we have, you know, basically be pro-veteran while being anti-defense spending. I think that's the way he constructs it. And it's been pretty successful. It's actually, I'd like to see where veterans break down, because they're a bigger factor in South Carolina. And it's amazing. Like, they really, if you've seen one of his full speeches or seen his campaign literature, they really emphasize that he was drafted, went in the Air Force and served. I mean, he smacks Gingrich around that, on that in the debate.
Right.
I mean, so it's actually, again, I keep thinking of 2004. There he kind of makes this argument that you can call him an isolationist, but he served and you didn't, and you have to shut up about it. So he's got, I use radical in kind of the Gingrich way, not in a pejorative way.
No, I understand.
Very different conception of how this stuff should work.
Now, what is your sense now? He certainly did significantly better than he did in 2008.
He tripled his vote base, basically, whereas Romney got about 18,000 more votes.
What do you think is attracting people to him? Is it the foreign policy talk? Is it the talk about fiat money? Or is it just that he keeps saying, you know, we got to have liberty and freedom, which I don't know really what that means, but it sounds good.
I actually went to a polling place. I closed out the night at one of the polling places in Manchester that he won. It was a very working class precinct. I talked to a few voters, and one guy who talked out, he had paint all over his clothes, a big mullet. He was a construction worker, and he voted for Paul. I mean, he might vote Democrat later in the line, but he's a union guy who voted for Paul just because he thought the debt was too big, and that he was worried about the cost of living. And I don't think he'd done reams of research on it, but
right.
Paul was the one talking about the value of the dollar. And just talking about it, I mean, being the first person to get out there and explain your position on something, I think gets people a lot of gets you a lot of points to people. They've had time to study him, and I'm not saying there's ignorance here. They're noticing that Romney's campaign is a lot more. He started to have some details about entitlement reform and things like that, but it's a lot more vague. His stump speech is probably like the glossiest, gauziest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
Where if you've heard it, he just talks literally, he'll quote long sections of patriotic songs that he likes. Whereas if you listen to Paul, it's a 30-minute lecture on monetary policy. And, you know, I think if there was a critic of Austrian economics in the room, he could probably mic check him and debate him. But no one really is. So they hear this guy who seems to mean this is not a new thing in politics. I mean, this probably goes back to ancient Greece. Guy steps up on a box and talks about something you haven't heard about it and you're interested.
Right. That part actually makes sense to me. I mean, because, you know, I listened to his speech intently and, you know, you hear liberty, freedom, fiat money. It sounds evil. People know that like gold is at, whatever it is, $2,200 an ounce, $22,000 an ounce, wherever it is. Gold is good. Fiat money sounds bad. And, I can understand, he's the only one who's saying these words. And if you're sick of politicians, I think you could be attracted to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually, his vote looks a lot like the vote for Pat Buchanan, 1996. Pete Gannon got 27% in New Hampshire. Paul got 23 or 24. He won pretty well in working class areas. And it's a similar thing. Happily, even though Paul will traffic with some people who are anti-immigrant, it's not based on that. It's just the entire system is broken and no one will tell you but me.
Right.
Whereas Romney's a little bit more reductionist. It's, well, Barack Obama broke everything and I'll fix it, which is what every candidate says. So
right.
He's
now, there's a little bit of Alex Jones in that Ron Paul thing, and I don't think there's...
Oh, there's a lot of Alex Jones in it.
And so is it ever possible, two things in terms of Paul, would Ron Paul ever be Mitt Romney's vice president, A, and B, would Ron Paul, do you have the sense that he would actually... bolt the Republican Party, or is he just trying to get to the convention and maybe, I don't know, go into the cabinet, set up his son in some way? What?
No, I actually think he's definitely irritated with being asked if he's going to run third party, because at this point, you know, he beats Rick Perry by 24 points or 22 points in a primary, and no one's asking Rick Perry if he's going to leave the party.
People are asking Rick Perry why you're still in the race.
Rick Perry would to count to an integer, a prime number, but and seeing if he can do it or not.
Right.
So with Paul, we ask him this. I don't ask him it very often, but I mean, at his victory party last night, he had supporters who were. I was kind of asking what the end game was because, you know, Paul would have, you know, at the best case scenario for Paul is that he wins a bunch of delegates, but
right.
He can't win the nomination.
Right.
What's the end game? And they do say, like, oh, I really just want him to be in the hunt until November. Like, we need him to be president, which means they want him to run third party. I don't think he's as interested in it because he didn't win last time, and he's gotten extremely successful. His son is in power. He's got a couple of acolytes in Congress. If he left, he basically would be, you know, one of the most famous public speakers in America with a son who's a senator. Who can draw like a crowd of 1,000 people to talk about monetary policy, which is kind of a dream of his. Whereas you risk, if you look at the Ralph Nader experience, if you run for president and you screw, people will always blame you no matter how the exit polls actually broke down. So he risks, screwing up that legacy if he gets out of the Republican Party. But, how do you transfer this enormous movement? Barack Obama tried to transfer a different kind of movement, but, people who loved him and said they would, that him being elected would change America, and, you know, they lose interest in a while. It's really tough. Running for president is, Paul's been kind of uniquely good at turning into something galvanizing, but I think he's learned in the past that running third party doesn't get you much further. I think he's going to try something else this time.
Right. I mean, it's a reasonable question to ask a guy if you've done it before. I mean, it's not like,
it is,
you know,
and
it's not like somebody's dreaming up this idea. The guy's done it before.
His people want, I mean, he has supporters who really wanted him to do it. So,
right.
You know, they,
so, South Carolina, I know you, had a very good sense of what was going to happen in New Hampshire, some time ago. What do you think is going to happen in South Carolina?
I actually think the thing is, South Carolina will always talk about how it has this conservative voters or the defining mass there. But really, if you look at the history of it, it just kind of validates whoever the establishment wants. I mean, Bob Dole wasn't the consensus conservative, and he won it.
Right.
George H.W. Bush wasn't a consensus conservative, he won it. McCain had a split primary going grand. But if you look at who the people actually voted for, I mean, Mike Huckabee topped out at 33% of the vote. So I think that Romney will have to screw up basically every day in order to lose that primary. And if he does, you're just going to see more people dropping, coalescing. You're going to see, I want to see what Jim DeMint does, because I actually met a few voters in New Hampshire who liked him. One voter who said he voted for Paul because he wanted DeMint to run and DeMint didn't. And I think that's one of the most powerful endorsements in the Republican Party at this point. I mean, Haley endorsed him too, but Haley, because she actually has to govern, Nikki Haley has alienated some people. If you're a senator who just lobs Molotov cocktails all day, you get to remain a hero. And I think, you know, if DeMint wants to wrap this up pretty fast, he can do that. He might too, because who is the, if you're DeMint and you're looking at this field, you've got Paul, who you think is kind of crazy, at least in terms of can't win, you don't agree with him on policy. Gingrich, who you don't trust. Santorum, who if you're an earmark guy, you don't trust. And they overlapped for really just one term in the Senate, but they fought on earmarks. I mean,
right.
2006 was a period when Tom Coburn and Jim DeMint and these guys were trying to ban earmarks, and Dan Santorum wasn't. So, I mean, it's totally possible that, like, DeMint, I just love the scenario because he could lock this down for Mitt Romney, and this would be the final primary act of the Tea Party movement, would be to validate Mitt Romney's presidential campaign.
Yeah, that would be pretty hilarious, actually, in a way. Now, that group of arch conservatives like Dobson and et al, who are supposedly meeting in Texas, I guess they're going to meet this weekend. Do you think
right.
anything's going to come out of that, or are they basically going to say, eh, we can't agree?
They couldn't agree before. I mean, in Iowa was a place where Rick Santorum clearly had everything in the background on the ground to win the caucuses. And it was big news that Bob Vanderplas endorsed him. Bob Vanderplas's group did not. They couldn't agree on whether to get involved in this. I think at this point, it's kind of tragic, because I remember there's a story from Paul Weyrich, who's an old conservative activist, really influential, who died, I think, in 2009, spoke at an event in 2009 and cried, saying, I wish we'd all endorsed, or he didn't cry, sorry, he was emotionally said we should have coalesced behind Huckabee instead of letting this McCain disaster happen. So they basically let the same thing happen. I mean, if Santorum, who, despite that one election loss, does have some credibility as a politician, if they had been behind him for a while and he'd been in a position to come second in New Hampshire and build a national campaign, I think they'd be pretty confident getting all behind him now. But I really feel like it's too late, and there's going to be people who pragmatically say that they trust Romney.
Right.
And Romney's now done a lot of outreach over years to these people.
And now we're going to be stuck with contraception forever in this country.
Dave
Weigel.
Yeah.
Slate.com, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Matt Richards of Occupy New Hampshire. Get his rap on the New Hampshire primary. We'll be right back after this.
Yeah.
are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Matt from Occupy Manchester, Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program, Matt. Matt?
I mean, nice to be on.
Give me a sense. I'm just doing my due diligence here, wrapping up the New Hampshire primary. We know who won. How active was Occupy New Hampshire during these primary days?
We were very active. I saw it as a huge success. Occupy made its presence at every single campaign stop that the candidates made. We got our point out, and we were very active.
Yeah, Newt Gingrich apparently credits you guys with preventing him from speaking. This is a guy who gets $60,000 a speaking engagement. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, Matt. And so you really cost him a chunk of change.
Yeah, well, apparently he saw the Ron Paul people and the Occupy people outside his office, and they were all peace-loving, and he was so scared of them that he couldn't enter.
So give me a sense. I mean, tell me some of the actions that took place over the past couple of days.
We had a huge gay. I think the biggest action we had was the Gay Pride March in Manchester. We had a bunch of new people come into Occupy that weren't related to it. We marched from Elm Street to down Elm Street to Victory Park, and I was really happy with that. We had a funeral for the American Dream outside the St. Anselm's College debate. And of course we bird dogged all the candidates. I remember we went to Santorum's event on Friday. I was there for that, and we ended up filling the room and give a speech in the parking lot. And we've been doing all kinds of workshops in the park, films at the UU Church. It's been a really good week.
Now, you guys are occupying a park right across, I think it's from the Marriott Hotel, is that right?
It's across the street from the Radisson.
The Radisson. And how long has the encampment been there?
Well, we started setting up Friday morning. We've been leaving the park at 11 each night, but we've been working with our local police, and they've allowed us to keep our tents up there. We have a permit for the park, and we just took everything down Tuesday. So it's been a 4 or 5 day encampment.
And is it your sense that your actions brought more people into the movement? I mean, I think, is that how you would measure the success?
Yes, I would measure the success by how much it has grown, and secondly, how strongly our message got out there. And when you hear, I read this article about how all the candidates are now adopting Occupy lingo because we won't go away, and news calling Romney a job killer because a vulture capitalist. I mean, when you see how much we've changed the discourse because we won't go away, I think that's really successful too.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really is a stunning achievement, and the pushback by the establishment of the Republican Party, because, you know, I think that the attacks on Romney for his work with Bain Capital, at the very least, have been adopted so wholeheartedly by his rivals because Occupy has set that narrative in a broader context. So give me a sense. I mean, how do you measure whether or not you've brought new people into the movement?
Well, we got tons of people come by the park, ask us why we were there, sign up for our email lists. We got people who had never been part of Occupy, who we met on the Gay Pride March, and they said they supported us. And we've definitely, I don't have the numbers, but right. We've definitely brought people in.
Well, that's great. And so what are you guys up in New Hampshire planning for the coming weeks?
Well, we're going to, we've been planning this primary for like 3 months now, and we've been hustling to get like 250 people bed space and get all this food in and get like all the infrastructure needs met. And we've all been working really hard, and we're going to take a break for about a week. But I see coming up in the future, we're going to be taking a lot of local actions. We're going to be, there are a lot of anti-worker bills in the legislature right now, the New Hampshire legislature. We can focus our energy on the New Hampshire legislature and try to create a change there. I know there's some anti-gay marriage bills in there, too. I actually got a bunch of occupiers to phone bank for gay marriage and get people to voice their concerns to their legislators. And what else do we have other than that? We're hoping to do more about the foreclosure crisis. Mm-hmm. We've been, I know I was talking to someone from Occupy Nashua. They knew some people that were familiar with foreclosure experts in Boston. So I'm hoping to do more with that too.
That's fantastic. And lastly, what would you say to other occupies around the country that may be planning to stage their own protests during the primaries? Was there anything in particular that stuck out to you that might be a good piece of advice for them?
Well, I thought our relationship with the police was a model that everyone else could follow. We didn't have like many arrests at all. And none related to the actual occupying. We maintained a good relationship with them. So that's always a good thing to have. As far as advice, I think they should disrupt the cedar of the election process that the Republicans are doing, but they shouldn't disrupt the actual voting because that turns people away.
Great. Great piece of advice. Attack that theater, but don't infringe upon anybody's rights, except for maybe
Absolutely.
Newt Gingrich to make $60,000 a speaking engagement.
Huh?
I was going to talk about Newt Gingrich. Just a joke. All right, Matt, from Occupy New Hampshire, Occupy Manchester, I should say. Thank you so much. I appreciate the work you did up there this past week. I know it was an incredible task to get this thing organized. You obviously weren't the only person, but all
we had a lot of hard workers here.
Please send my thanks and congratulations to everybody up there, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
All right, folks, we've got to take a break briefly as we head into the better half of the program. First off, let me thank you. We are nearly, I think we've nearly, if not already, achieved Jeff Smith's goal that he set for himself to get down to D.C. And spend the week as part of Occupy D.C. So thank you and congratulations. Folks, if you haven't become a member of the Majority Report, we really need you to. Not all of you. We don't need all of you to, but we need you to. Not you two as in two people. I mean you to become a member. Y'all need to become a member of the Majority Report because it is only your membership which makes this show possible and ensures that it will continue. If you cannot afford a membership but want access to the better half of the program, the extra 50 minutes. Today, for instance, I'll talk about the 10-year anniversary of Gitmo. I'll talk a story that's really should be music to the ears of Jimmy Reefer Cake. And more. If you cannot afford it, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. People have been contributing and continue to contribute to donate, to support members getting the full access to the show if they have a financial hardship. I will not let anybody not have access because of financial hardship reasons. In the after show, we'll talk about what's going down with food stamps in Pennsylvania. It's disgusting. So, but if you can afford to become a member and you enjoy this show 3 times a week, 4 times a week, 5 times a week, twice a week, please do. It'll ensure its continuity. We'll take your phone calls coming up next, your IMs, all that and more in the better half of the program.